This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, it's going to be all about cheese. Yeah, including the inventor J.L. Kraft and his revolutionary product, processed cheese. We'll tell you how to make it, and we'll tell you just what is in cheese food. But first, for you Jurassic Park fans, you remember the scene where the scientists learn how InGen was able to create their dinosaurs?
This fossilized tree sap, which we call amber, waited for millions of years with the mosquito inside until Jurassic Park scientists came along. Using sophisticated techniques, they extract the preserved blood from the mosquito and, bingo, dino DNA.
In a study out in Science Advances, researchers didn't find dino DNA, but they did find a 99-million-year-old lizard preserved in amber. Ariel Duham Ross is here to tell us that story and other selected short subjects in science. She's a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Wow. What did they find in the amber there?
So they found a chameleon. And like you said, it's 99 million years old. That means that it is the oldest preserved chameleon or chameleon in ancestor ever found. What's really important about this is that when scientists find these kinds of preserved animals, they are able to kind of trace the evolution of these animals through time and figure out which trace arrived first. And in this case, the scientists realized that this chameleon did not have fused toes, the kinds of fused toes that modern chameleons use to climb trees. Instead, it did have signs that it has a projectile tongue, which means that the projectile tongue that chameleons have today may have evolved a lot earlier than scientists previously thought. These chameleons, there's one chameleon, the baby chameleon, and then a bunch of other lizards that were preserved in amber. They were found in a mine decades ago and kept by a private collector who eventually handed it over to some scientists. So it's kind of interesting that we're finding this out now, even though these objects were found, a really long time ago.
Stuff comes out of your collections and you look at it.
It changes the history of chameleon evolution.
A few weeks ago, there was a new species of ancient flower found in amber, right?
I saw that. The piece of amber was really, really beautiful.
Now, what is amber? People, they buy it. They're not quite sure what it is, but it's something really cool.
Right. Amber is fossilized tree resin. When certain types of trees, when they're damaged or diseased, they will release some resin to kind of cover the wounds that they have. And sometimes animals get trapped in that. Whether it's a lizard or an insect. And over time, millions and millions of years, when that resin is kind of submerged in sediment, it will turn into copal, which then millions of years later turns into amber. The process by which this happens is not very well understood. There are temperature conditions and pressure conditions that are very, very specific, and not every tree releases resin that will turn into amber. But every once in a while, we get lucky and we get something like a 99-million-year-old baby chameleon.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about another topic that was in the news this week. And this was kind of interesting because it was here, it was there. The first uterus transplant. It was announced as a success and then a failure all within the same week.
I think it was about 2 weeks ago, scientists at the Cleveland Clinic announced that they had done the first U.S. uterus transplant. There have been other uterus transplants in Sweden. I believe 9 women have had the procedure done. But this was the first time that this happened in the U.S., and unfortunately, this 26-year-old woman who had the transplant and who was born without a uterus, it failed. She had a complication, and they had to remove the uterus on Tuesday. It's an interesting procedure because it's still definitely investigational. So things like this will happen. The uterus is supposed to come from a deceased donor, and it's supposed to help these women then carry a child to term themselves, which they aren't normally able to do. So it's unfortunate that this happened. Yeah. There are still 9 other women who are supposed to have this procedure done. The trial is supposed to go ahead, according to the Cleveland Clinic. It's unclear what will happen to these 9 candidates now, if they will all go ahead with the operation now that the first one has failed.
Now, from what I understand, it's true that you're only borrowing the uterus? You give the uterus back?
To the researchers, not the corpse. So they are. It is a temporary procedure.
Yeah.
The idea is that you do the transplant. These women will have the uterus for a few years so they can have some children, carry some children to term. And then researchers will remove the uterus because the uterus is not an organ that is necessary for life. So, and unfortunately, when you have a transplant, you need to take a lot of anti-rejection drugs. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that taking it out will allow these women to go back to their regular lives where they don't have to take these drugs every day and they don't have to worry.
Mm-hmm. I have next, a story about how humans might have eaten before the idea of cooking.
Yeah, for a long time, scientists have thought that cooking may have been something that really started around 500,000 years ago, may have been what allowed humans to eat diverse foods and then become really, really brainy and intelligent. But a study out this week in Nature that was described by Carl Zimmer in the New York Times suggested that eating meat and the invention of stone cutting tools may have allowed humans to get the nutrients and the free time that they needed to gain the brain power that we have today. It's kind of interesting because what I like the most about this study is the way that it was conducted. The researchers separated study participants into different groups and gave them raw goat meat to eat, as well as some vegetables like yams and beets. And depending on which group you ended up in, you either had, you know, a slab of raw goat meat to chew on, or you had goat meat that had been cut up in little pieces. Mm-hmm. And because eating raw goat meat could give you food poisoning, the study participants then had to chew to spit it out. And the researchers were able to kind of measure the pieces and figure out, you know, how long it would take for humans to eat it. And they found out that it takes about 30 chews to eat small pieces of raw goat meat. But if you have a big slab, then humans aren't able to swallow it. It just doesn't work out. But the idea is that stone tools and being able to cut those up a lot earlier, 2 to 3 million years ago, may have started the process of us becoming more intelligent a lot faster. And that, you know, really changes the timeline for us. Not everybody agrees with the study. The guy who first came up with the cooking theory doesn't agree with it, but you know, we'll have to have more studies on that.
More goat meat on the way. Thank you, Ariel. Ariel Doom Ross is a science reporter at The Verge here in New York. Thanks again. Always good to see you.
Yeah, thank you.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And our story today talks about global temperatures. You know, we keep hearing about global temperatures continuing to rise. It's a matter of concern. And of course, because with the rising temperatures come rising sea levels. And while coastal communities are starting to think about how to fend off higher oceans with levees and pumps and raised foundations, others are considering even larger scale, very large scale approaches to coping with sea level rise. And writing this week in the journal Earth System Dynamics, researchers from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, they looked at the possibility of pumping all that excess seawater, pumping it into the interior of Antarctica, where it would freeze, right? You'd lower the level of the ocean by pumping out the ocean into Antarctica, locking it up in the ice. What could be bad about that? Well, here to talk about the good and bad of that is one of the authors of that paper, Anders Leverman. He's a climate scientist at the Potsdam Institute and professor of physics at the Institute of Potsdam University. He's also lead author of the Sea Level Change chapter of the most recent IPCC report, so he has thought about this a lot. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. This idea sounds sort of like fantastic. Is it a really a serious thought?
Some call it crazy.
I didn't say that word.
No, you didn't. I'm just saying. No, it is strange. It's a strange idea. You know, we don't want to mess up Antarctica. It's the only place on the planet where humans can only go for doing research and not for tourism or to explore it. So you don't really want to mess it up. But if you think about this idea, it becomes less insane the more you think about it, in a way, because there's no real ecosystem on Antarctica. There's a tremendous ecosystem around Antarctica, but not really in the interior. And it's very, very cold, so any water that you would put there would immediately freeze, and you would protect coastal cities and coasts all over the place on the entire globe.
And so what's bad about this idea?
Well, there are a lot of bad things about it. First, you would actually mess a little bit with the ecosystem around Antarctica. And the technology doesn't exist yet to really pump this amount of water at these temperatures, which are very, very cold in Antarctica. But what's the biggest problem is that the Antarctic ice sheet is indeed 2 kilometers high, and you would have to translate this into miles, because I'm from Europe and I just don't understand this.
It's a couple of miles. We'll call it a couple of miles.
A couple of miles, exactly. And if you just want to elevate this amount of water to reduce the sea level globally onto Antarctica, that would take about 7% of the global energy production, of the global energy consumption that we have at the moment. And that's just to eliminate the sea level rise that we are currently observing. If in the future we expect even higher sea level rise or even faster sea level rise, and there you would need even more energy. And that makes it problematic.
Would this be a permanent solution? Or is it a temporary
fix? No, it wouldn't be a permanent solution, but it would be in a sense, because you can store the ice there for 1,000 years if you put it in far enough inland. So that's kind of, it's not permanent, but 1,000 years is far into the future.
But do we have any idea what pumping all this brine, all this seawater up into Antarctica might do locally?
Yeah, there's more problems with this. As you know, Antarctica is snow, right? It's ice made of snow, which is fresh water. It doesn't have any salt in it. But the ocean water obviously has a lot of salt. So you would put a layer of salty water onto Antarctica. And at the moment, we don't know what this will do with the dynamics of the ice motion. Mm-hmm. So we have to say, this is actually a very problematic idea, and we initially thought we'll have to try it, because it's not just rich countries that are going to be affected by sea level rise, it's also poor countries, and then you have regions on the planet which might not be economically important, but you want to keep anyway, like the mangrove forests in Florida, or the Florida Keys, for example, and you would protect all of these at the same time.
All right, we Anders, thank you very much. Gives us something to think about. Thanks for coming on and joining us. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go take a trip to Wisconsin. Everybody loves cheese. It's the World Championship Cheese Contest, and it's going to be Gouda. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you heard our show last week, you know that we're celebrating the science of cheese. Oh, we love cheese. I certainly do. From the gooey, the viscous physics of melted mozzarella, to the microbial mayhem behind your favorite fermented flavors. It's our spotlight this month with lots of stories for you to nibble on, and you can find it at sciencefriday.com/cheese. So what better way to celebrate than a trip to where else? The World Championship Cheese Contest. That championship happened this week in, of course, Madison, Wisconsin. And the judges had to taste nearly 3,000 different cheeses from 23 countries and 31 states. Christy Taylor of Wisconsin Public Radio tagged along with the judges on their tasting tour.
So my name is Lloyd Metzger. I'm a professor at South Dakota State University.
Tim Szymowski and Tim Cheesemowski is what my alias is.
All right, well, so walk me through what you do to sample this cheese.
So you need a device called a trier. That's what I've got in my hand. It's basically a curved stainless steel knife, essentially. And since we've got a 40-pound block, we have to try to get a representative sample of that cheese. So in the middle of the cheese, I'll push the trier through, and what it's going to allow me to do is remove a plug of cheese. Go ahead and smell that. You should get a nice...
That is a really strong cheddar smell.
Now, you'll take the plug, and one of the first things you do is look for any cracks in the cheese or any holes in the cheese. That would be an indicator of gas development, because we don't expect that in this cheese variety. In Swiss, we'd want a whole bunch of holes in there. The next thing we're going to do is bend it, and we want it to bend and then tear before it actually breaks and not snap. And it did that really well, so really a ideal texture for this cheese. And then we'll take a piece of the cheese and we'll squeeze it. And I want to squeeze it 4 times and see if it goes into a ball. And if it goes into a ball and doesn't fall apart, it's considered an ideal texture.
Before you even taste it, you've already felt it and have a bit of a relationship with what it's probably going to taste like.
You've already got this opinion that you're starting to form. Sometimes you're very disappointed when you finally put it in your mouth, when things have looked really good up to that point.
So we've been talking about putting the cheese in our mouths. Why don't we do that? Yeah.
Yeah, you put the cheese in the back of your mouth, along the sides of your tongue. You look for bitterness, you look for acid, you look for fruity, fermented, unclean flavors, sanitizer, all of those things. And there's a 100 other flavors that you can look for. After you've worked it into a ball, now you're starting to warm it up, and that'll actually help you detect the fine flavors. Some of the volatiles will come out.
And with this cheddar, it's so clean. It's got that mild, cheesy, nutty note, but then there's no bitterness, there's no excessive salt. It's just a very smooth, clean aftertaste in a cheddar cheese, which is very desirable.
You just spit out that piece of cheese,
yeah.
Lloyd.
That's the crime in all this, is you have to spit all the cheese out. You don't actually get to eat any of it. And you do that because if you swallow the cheese, that's all you're going to taste for the next several cheeses as you try to evaluate them. So you spit the cheese out, wash your mouth out several times, and then you can go on to the next sample.
All right, the finalists, the final two of the Sweet 16. It is the surface mold-ripened sheep's milk.
There you go. That was Christy Taylor of WPR with the cheese judges Tim Seismowski and Lloyd Metzger. And if you're wondering what cheese won the championship, well, I'm going to have Professor Metzger tell us himself all about it. He is truly a jack of all trades. Sorry, he joins us from South Dakota Public Broadcasting today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Are there enough cheese puns to go around for everything?
It has not occurred to me that they're done yet. Did you catch that one?
I did. You got a whole bunch in one, son. You've been practicing.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so
yeah.
Who won?
No way. You really shouldn't encourage me because I just keep going.
Well, don't be afraid because we're open to that. Tell us, who won the cheese championship this year?
The grand champion cheese was a smear-ripened hard cheese from Roth, USA. So it was a very unique cheese and a cheese that's very difficult to make. So when it's a smear-ripened cheese, you're going to put a smear consortium of bacteria on the surface of that cheese that's going to provide unique flavor. When it's a hard cheese, it's similar to what you would think of a Parmesan cheese, so it has some very nutty, unique flavors. And then it's in a category that are called Alpine cheeses, where you like to have a particular feed for the cows that produce the milk to make the cheese that provides kind of a flowery taste to the cheese. So you have this whole combination of flavors from the smear ripened, from the milk source, and then from the organisms that were used to make that cheese, and you get this flowery, nutty, slightly rancid combination of flavors that's really a nice bouquet of flavors and really almost hard to describe.
Send some over, would you?
I'll get right on it.
One of the things that you've written about, and one of the reasons we first got in touch with you, was to find out what exactly is processed cheese. We've seen it on so many ingredients. We've seen it as cheese food, processed. Give us the summary. What is processed cheese? What's the difference?
The age-old question. I really wish I could simply answer that, but it really gets down to the details of, is it really processed cheese and what category is it? So I would love it if consumers would go to the grocery store and actually read what it says on their labels. And you'll see terms like pasteurized processed cheese food, pasteurized processed cheese spread, and pasteurized processed cheese product. And all of those products will be in the same category in the store. They'll look very much alike, but the ingredients and how those cheeses were made will vary dramatically. So it's a really hard question to answer.
Well, but people get the impression that it's sort of synthetic.
Yeah, and that's clearly not the case. So when you make a processed cheese, you actually start with a natural cheese. And actually, this goes back to the early 1900s. J.L. Kraft, and I'm sure you recognize the Kraft name, had a cheese cart that he would take around Chicago and sell cheese, and his cheddar cheese that he was using would spoil. And so he started to pursue a technique where he could pasteurize the cheese that would allow him to have it for an extended period and it wouldn't immediately spoil. And that's kind of where processed cheese started in America. At the same time in Switzerland, they were starting to make fondues. And if you took certain types of cheese and added a particular type of wine to the cheese, you would make a very nice, smooth, creamy fondue type cheese that was the earliest processed cheeses that were being developed in Europe at the time. So bottom line, to make a processed cheese, you need to start with a natural cheese, and then you have to add some type of ingredient called an emulsifying salt. And that can be something as simple as a wine or a lemon juice and some baking soda, because basically what you need is a chelator that will bind the calcium and cause this cheese to actually form a nice, smooth, velvety, creamy texture. And I guess I'll try to explain it with a picture. So everybody's had spaghetti, and you can imagine a bowl of spaghetti where all the strands are interacting with each other. It's in a great big pile in a bowl. You got that picture in your head?
I got it. I'm eating it, but I got it.
Yeah, okay. Now, what we do when we add an emulsifying salt is we make all those strands of spaghetti unravel and be individual strands. Mm-hmm. And when we do that and unravel all those strands will actually interact with any fat and any water that are present in that cheese, and then the cheese will no longer leak oil and won't have water that comes out of it. And with a little mixing and heating, you make this very nice, smooth, creamy product.
So what?
And that's basically what you're doing when you're making processed cheese.
Well, so what I'm hearing is, you know, cheese is processed milk to begin with, right? So you're
Correct.
Just processing it a little differently.
Exactly. And it's really about extending the shelf life of the product. That's why processed cheese was developed, was trying to get cheese to stop where it was. Because everybody knows this. If you take a cheese and put it in your refrigerator, it's alive and it keeps changing over time. And the characteristics of that cheese rapidly change over time. And it can be a good change if it's a very nice aged cheddar, or it can spoil in your refrigerator.
All right. Let's...
So processed cheese was designed to try to arrest and stop that ripening process.
Let's talk a little bit about cheese chemistry in food, for example. American cheese melts so well on a burger, but why doesn't cheddar melt like that? What's going on there?
Okay, so when you make cheddar cheese, you use an enzyme to form the coagulum that produces that curd, and it very loosely entraps the milk fat that's present in the milk. And so when you heat that product up, the fat actually leaks out of the cheese, and you get this kind of oily, gloppy mess that you get with a natural cheese like cheddar. With a processed cheese, we took those spaghetti strands and de-aggregated them, took them all apart, and now they hold on to that water and fat and make it very smooth and creamy, just like you would if you made a cream sauce on a stovetop.
Hmm. And then you have cheeses like Fontina that aren't processed, right?
Correct. And if you get the cheese to ripen to exactly the right amount and have the right level of the protein being broken down, it will actually make a smooth and creamy cheese. But you have to have the age of the cheese exactly right, and it'll only do it for a short period of time. Mm-hmm. With processed cheese, we give it that heat treatment, and then it's going to stay that way for a much longer period of time.
Now, I understand that it's actually not that hard to make melty nacho cheese. Without
That's
it separating
correct.
Into an oily mess. And this is something that people can try at home.
Yep. Just go buy some mild cheddar cheese or even a medium cheddar cheese and put that on a saucepan on your stovetop. Add some water to it, and then also add some lemon juice and a little bit of baking soda. And just stir it up with a whisk, and you'll get this very smooth, creamy product. If you want it to be thinner, add a little bit more water to it, and you can really get your nice nacho cheese sauce at home.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, we have a recipe at sciencefriday.com/nacho cheese on our website. And while we're on the subject of American cheese, I asked about it before melting on a burger. Is there really any fundamental difference between a mild American cheddar and something like a Jack?
Yeah, you will use a slightly different make procedure in different cultures to produce those two cheeses, and then they'll have a different moisture content as well. So you use a slightly different bacteria, a slightly different manufacturing process to change the composition of that cheese.
Mm-hmm. If anybody has any questions about the cheese they want to get in the last few minutes, our phone number, phone lines are open, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Do you have a favorite cheese of your own?
I have. That's like asking if one of my children is
my
favorite.
I know. I was gonna preface that with that exact phrase, but
so I like several of them equally well. So I really like a very highly aged cheddar cheese just because I've done so much research on them over the years. I actually had a cheese that I made when I was in graduate school 25 years ago that I carried with me from university to university until it was 15 years old. That was quite a good cheese by then. But I also like blue cheese as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when we had that tour of the contest, what happens to all those cheeses? I mean, are they just available there? Can we get them? What happens to them?
So there's the top 16 cheeses in the contest actually are auctioned to raise money for scholarships for students that are in various food and dairy science programs in the United States. Then the remaining portion of the cheeses are actually donated to a food pantry in Madison, Wisconsin. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is there a wrong way to eat cheese? A right
no.
Way?
No. Well,
I mean, do you let it? Should you let it all come to room temperature? Or, you know, or, it's like I'm going to go into your dairy subjects, like ice cream. They say you should let it melt a little bit so it doesn't freeze your taste buds. You can get the flavor of the.
Yeah.
Is the same thing with cheese?
Well, no, you can. Cheese, it's nice if it's warmed up a little bit toward room temperature, but your mouth is going to continue to warm it up. The big thing is to don't be the typical American pig and chew it twice and swallow it. You got to give it a little bit of time in your mouth and let that product melt. It really is good to breathe a little bit because actually some of the flavors will go up retronasally and you'll actually get a better sense of the cheese if you breathe in a little bit.
Oh, yes, keep breathing. Talking with Lloyd Metzger, the cheese baron, he's professor in the dairy education department at South Dakota State University in Brookings on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. What question do you get most about cheese?
The one you just asked was, what's your favorite cheese? And then the second one really is about processed cheese. Is it really cheese? I mean, you can go on YouTube and watch videos about fake cheese, and people really wonder what's in it.
Right. All right, let's go to the phones. John, now he's got a question for you. Go ahead. Welcome to Science Friday. Come on. we lost him. All right, let's go to Laurie in Malden, Massachusetts. Hi, Laurie.
Hi.
Hey there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Conversation was very interesting, and I wanted to ask how it could apply to macaroni and cheese. Like, trying to use real cheddar cheese comes out grainy usually.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. How do you do it? Yeah, what's the secret?
So the cheese used in macaroni and cheese really needs to be a processed cheese to not have that grainy texture. So if you wanted to do that, you could follow that nacho cheese recipe that's on the website and then use that cheese in macaroni and cheese. But if you use just a straight cheddar, you'll get a very gloppy, oily product that's really doesn't have that desirable velvet, melty characteristic that you're after in your macaroni and cheese.
What, Dr. Metzger, is the holy grail for cheese scientists?
Well, 10 to 15 years ago, it was, could we make cheese that had less fat in it and less salt in it and still taste good? And why would you want to do that, first of all? It tastes so wonderful. But really, the holy grail of cheese is trying to get the flavor that you want every time. So there's so many steps that go into the cheese manufacturing process and the ripening stages that if you screw any one up, it will magnify any bad flavors that you have and negate all the good flavors in that cheese. So if there was a way to more consistently get the flavor that you want every time, it'd sure make cheese manufacturers happier, and I think consumers too, because they'd more likely get the cheese that they want every time.
If you wanted to try cheese making at home, what would be the easiest, best way to learn?
The easiest, best way is to probably do, you can do a fresh mozzarella type cheese that you can stretch and then make fresh mozzarella balls out of. That's an easy cheese to make, and you can use lemon juice as your acidulant to actually help coagulate the milk. So it's a pretty easy one to do is mozzarella.
I'm glad you brought that up because we have that on our website. We actually visited a great mozzarella cheesemaker in the Bronx. And so it's on our website at sciencefriday.com/cheese. This gentleman we had was, you know, put his hands in boiling water for 30 years pulling them up.
Yes, you need to be a really old Italian with these red hands. When I do it, I put rubber gloves on because I'm a sissy from South Dakota.
Well, your Wisconsin people appreciate hearing that, I'm sure, all the cheesemakers. Lloyd, thank you very much for taking time to be with us. I can't give me a pun to end with. What's your best pun?
My best pun? I'll tell you a cheese joke, I guess.
Quickly,
There was an explosion in the French cheese factory. What was left?
I give up.
Debris.
Oh, I love it. All right, everybody's heard that one for this evening. Floyd Metzger, a pun artist, is professor in the Alfred Chair in Dairy Education at South Dakota State University in Brookings. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're gonna still talk about cheese. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking cheese this hour. And for you cheese aficionados, you know that pairing cheese with the perfect wine or beer can really enhance the flavors of your fromage. A Merlot brings out the mushroominess of a nice Gouda, or an amber ale with a sharp cheddar. I'm getting very hungry here. But if you're a cheese geek and you really want to understand what makes those cheese tastes and textures, you need to match your cheese with its microbes. Yes, microbes. My next guest says that 10 billion microbial cells live on just the rind alone. Talk about flavor enhancers. She's even sequenced the colonies on the rind of 160 different cheeses. She's here to walk us through the microbiology behind our favorite ones. Rachel Dutton is assistant professor of molecular biology, University of California in San Diego. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You know, I'm not sure a lot of people realize that there are bacteria involved in all parts of cheese and cheese making, but you specifically focus on the rind. Why the rind?
Yeah, well, bacteria are actually important for pretty much every delicious food that we eat. So whether we're thinking about cheese or beer or wine, these microbes actually have an important role. And we're really interested in cheese because it is an example of a simple ecosystem that we can really pull apart and put back together in the lab and understand how microbes actually build communities and fight with each other, help each other, communicate. And the rind of cheese has this amazing biofilm-like structure. So it's actually a completely separate community of microbes that grows on the surface of cheese during the aging process.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk about microbes and the rind and cheese and whatever. And in the cheese making, you purposely put the microbes to make the rind?
So in some cheeses, you do. So if you think about a brie or a camembert, those cheeses, you actually add specific types of fungi and sometimes bacteria to make the rind of the cheese. So if you look at those cheeses, you see this fluffy white surface on the cheese. And so that's actually all microbes. So the fluffiness is the Penicillium camemberti, which, as you can probably tell, was named after camembert cheese. And Penicillium gives the cheese some of these sort of mushroomy flavors. And then you also have two other really interesting microbes. One is a fungus called Geotrichum, and one is a bacterium called Hafnia. And together, they produce a lot of the sort of cauliflowery kind of smells and tastes that you get in these really ripe camemberts.
That penicillin, is it an antibiotic too when we eat it?
It's not, but it is. It's sort of a cousin of the fungus that produces the antibiotic penicillin. Yeah.
Now there are bacteria inside the cheese versus the stuff that's on the rind. Does that mean that the inside of the cheese is going to have a different flavor given by those microbes than the ones that are closer to the rind?
Yeah, exactly. So there's the lactic acid bacteria inside the cheese. So those are the species that were used to acidify the milk and produce the fresh curds. And so the sort of closer you get to the rind, the more intense a flavor is often in the cheese. So if you, again, think about something like a brie, you often have the cheese starting to get really gooey just underneath the rind, so it's ripening. And that's because the activity of the microbes growing on the surface, they're actually producing a lot of the molecules that cause the cheese to ripen. So it's sort of ripening from the outside in.
Yeah, no, there are people who are afraid to eat the rind. Are they missing the whole part of the cheese if you don't eat the rind?
Absolutely, yeah. So those microbes are incredibly tasty. I encourage people to at least give it a nibble and see what they think.
And how many kinds of rinds are there?
There are, if you think of different kinds of cheeses, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different cheeses. And we can kind of classify rinds into maybe three major groups. So we have the three... So the first group would be these bloomy rind cheese is what we call them. So the brie and camembert style ones. And then we have the rinds, which during the aging process, the cheesemakers will actually wash the surface of the cheese with a salt water solution. And those create this really stinky, funky flavors in the cheese. And so those are called the washed rinds. Mm-hmm. And then the third variety of rind that we think about is the natural rind. So this is where you make the cheese, so something like a cheddar, and you put it into a cave and you just let it be. Let the microbes colonize, don't really mess with it. And you have a completely different type of microbial community that forms on these three different types of rinds.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones because lots of people love cheese and they are interested. Let's go to Moscow, Idaho. And Hannah, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira, thanks.
Go ahead, sure.
Okay, so I had a question. My mom, growing up, whenever we got mold or fungus or any fuzzies on the cheese in our home or in our fridge, she would always cut that part off and then we could use it. She would always say, oh, it's just mold, it's not going to hurt you. And so she would cut it off. I didn't know where that came from. Does that come from the cheese itself, or would that happen in the packaging facility, or where would that come from?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, so there's mold all around us, and there's sort of wild species of mold that are often closely related to the ones we find in cheeses that are just in your home, say floating around your kitchen. And so once you slice into the cheese, you create this open environment that any microbe floating around might want to grow on. So often when you cut into the cheese and you put it in your refrigerator, some of those microbes might start growing on there. And they actually like cool temperatures like your refrigerator. So it's sort of like a cheese cave. So that's probably where they're coming from.
Is it safe to eat that mold that's growing on there?
I probably wouldn't recommend eating it, but yeah, if you sort of cut it away, that seems to be fine.
All right, let's go to another phone call. Let's go to Molly in Groton, Massachusetts. Hi, Molly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my question is that I have passionately fallen in love with goat cheese over the past 5 or 10 years, the brie goat cheese, the cheddar goat cheese. What is that flavor? I've almost stayed away from cow cheese altogether.
Yeah, so goat milk. Most cheese is made from one of three different kinds of milk. So you have cow, goat, and sheep. And they have some similarities, but each of them have different properties that are interesting in cheese making. And goat milk has a lot of these special sort of fatty acids that have these interesting flavor properties. So you have things that are specific to goat milk that have these sort of spicy, tangy flavors that you don't find in cow or sheep milk.
Hmm. Quite interesting. So do you have a favorite cheese, Molly, a goat cheese? Well, Molly might be gone.
I mentioned the brands, but I really love the brie and the cheddar. I like the hard cheeses better than the soft cheeses.
Yeah, and let me ask. Thank you for calling. So Rachel, what makes a hard cheese versus a soft cheese? What's going on there that turns it soft or keeps it hard?
Yeah, so a lot of that has to do with what the cheesemaker is doing to the milk and the curds when they first make the cheese. So if you heat the curds to a higher temperature, that will help get rid of moisture. If you press the curds once you've made the first wheel, that will also get rid of moisture. So the more moisture you remove at the beginning of the cheesemaking process, the firmer the cheese will be and the longer you can age that cheese. So things like the cloth-bound cheddars, you can age them for a year or more. And that's because they have a low moisture, which actually slows down the growth of microbes. So you can kind of control how quickly the microbes grow and how quickly your cheese ripens by how much moisture is in the cheese.
And all that's the veins running through gorgonzola, whatever. Were they put in there or did the cheese make them?
Yeah, so those are really fascinating. So those are due to a microbe. It's a fungus. Again, it's a Penicillium species, but this Penicillium is called Penicillium roqueforti, so named after Roquefort cheese in France. And this particular species of Penicillium produces this blue pigment. and it only grows in low oxygen environments. So when cheesemakers make this cheese, they actually take the spores of the fungus and mix it into the milk, so it's all over throughout the milk and throughout the cheese. And then after they've made the wheel of cheese, they actually take a metal spike and punch holes into the cheese to make these little cracks throughout the wheel.
Mm.
And oxygen can get into these cracks, and that little bit of oxygen is what stimulates the growth of Penicillium roqueforti. And it starts to grow. It produces these beautiful blue-green pigments as it's growing. And the other interesting thing it does is not just producing this color, it's actually doing a lot to the flavor of these cheeses. So anytime you eat a blue cheese, you recognize that you've eaten a blue cheese, right? It's a very sort of distinctive flavor. And that's because this mold, Penicillium roqueforti, is breaking down the fat in milk, and it's releasing these free fatty acids. So some of these free fatty acids have the spicy, peppery flavor that you associate with blue cheese. So the more blue mold you have in the cheese, the spicier the cheese will be. And then it actually can break those down further and produce these volatile molecules, so very small molecules that we can smell. And so there's one of these molecules that it produces called 2-heptanone, and that's one of the key aromas of blue cheese. So when you're smelling blue cheese, you're actually smelling the byproducts of this fungus as it's growing.
Wow, that is complex stuff going on. And I understand that you have even found marine bacteria on some cheeses. How did they get there?
Yeah, we don't know. So on these washed rind cheeses that I mentioned, so where the cheesemakers will wash the surface with a salty solution of water, we actually find many organisms, many bacteria that we normally would find in the ocean, which is sort of perplexing. And so we still don't know exactly where they're coming from, but we think it's probably from the sea salt that's being used in cheesemaking, or it could be due to the fact that cheese itself is a very salty environment, and these microbes are used to growing in salty environments, so they just happen to find an environment that they really love.
Yeah, well, speaking of loving, I want to remind our listeners, we also have a nacho cheese recipe on our website if you want to make try that. It's at sciencefriday.com/nacho cheese. To go along with all the other cheese stuff we have going on our website there. And a quick reminder that this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Rachel Dutton, Assistant Professor of Molecular Biology, UC San Diego. Do you ever get tired of talking about cheese, Rachel?
No, I feel like I have the best job in the world. I get to talk about cheese. I get to study cheese in my lab. It's wonderful.
I asked our last guest for a favorite cheese, and it was like, you know, what's your favorite son or daughter? It's impossible.
Yeah.
Do you dare I ask that of you?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot. One of the things I love the most about cheese is how much diversity there is. So you can go to a cheese shop and there's hundreds of varieties, and every time you can experience a new set of flavors. One of my favorite cheeses sort of is a cheese that we actually study a lot in my lab. So we collect samples from all over the world, and a cheesemaker that we work with a lot is Jasper Hill Farm in Vermont, and they make a blue cheese called Bailey Hazen Blue, which I love, and it's sort of our lab rat. We're very interested in the microbes there, and it's just a delicious cheese besides being very interesting from a scientific perspective.
Yeah, I'd go get some of that to research, too. Let's go to Portland, Oregon with Michael. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. My question is about storage of cheese. I've always been taught to wrap it in plastic to keep the oxygen out, and then I just was in a fancy kitchen store that had something called a cheese vault, where it said air was important to be around the cheese when you're storing it.
Yeah, so because cheese is alive, and the microbes in it, if you want to keep those microbes alive and happy, you want to allow them to have a little bit of oxygen. So if you wrap it in plastic wrap, this sort of you're suffocating the microbes on the cheese.
That's kind of interesting. Thanks for the call. That brings up the question, Can every cheese batch or what, however you call it, be the same? I mean, if there are microbes and bacteria and different kinds of stuff floating in the air, isn't every what's the wheel or whatever? What do you call a batch of cheese, Rachel?
Yeah, a batch of cheese. Yeah.
Okay. Are they going to all be different, really?
Yeah. So you can have, you know, differences depending on the season, where the milk is coming from. But it's sort of amazing to me how reproducible cheese can be. And so that's part of why we're interested in studying these microbial communities that form on the surface, because it's sort of, you can think about it as humans over thousands of years have figured out ways to very precisely manipulate how microbial communities form. And we sort of know exactly the conditions to create on the cheese, and those conditions will sort of allow the growth of a certain type of cheese rind versus another. So you can have sort of subtle variations, but kind of if you zoom out a little bit, it's kind of amazing how reproducible they are.
All right, here's my last question: is what is your holy grail for cheese? What do you need to know?
Yeah, well, we're really trying to understand how a microbial community is organized. So what I would love to be able to do is figure out how all of these microbes are communicating with each other. Are they fighting? Are they helping? So what are all the molecules that are being shared amongst the community, and how are the species interacting?
Yeah. With all these microbes, do we know how it might interact with our own microbiome, all the cheese you're eating?
Yeah, so we actually had a study a couple years ago where we fed human subjects cheese and followed the microbes. And actually, many of the microbes can survive the gastrointestinal tract. So we're becoming more and more interested in the interaction of microbes from fermented foods with the human gut microbiome.
Wow. Rachel, you're welcome back anytime to talk about cheese.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Rachel Dutton is Assistant Professor of Molecular Biology at UC San Diego. And you can check out our full melting pot of cheese stories, get it, at Cheese Spotlight. That's sciencefriday.com/cheese. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer, our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff, Luke Graskin, our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Just to say it again, if you love cheese, we've got all kinds of cheese videos, cheese recipes up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.